Ned Griffin, because he gave me an inspiration to go on and do what I've done. And certainly Ed has been there distributing videos. And we'll tell you how to get his videos. And now I understand he has a new tape ministry that putting out tapes all across America, trying to educate people as to what's going on. Ed, it's so good to have you with us.
Well, thank you, Stan. That's very, very kind introduction of me. I had forgotten that we do, in fact, go back that many years, don't we?
We certainly do. Well, we're going to talk this evening about the origins of wars and revolutions, because Ed has written probably one of the finest books on this subject available any place. It's called The Creature from Jekyll Island. And, of course, it talks about the background to our monetary system. But, of course, going along with an understanding of our monetary system, you have to understand that all the wars of this generation, really all the wars of this century and the revolutions, have not been accidental. They've been very carefully orchestrated. And certainly one of the most important wars was the First World War. In fact, without an understanding of the origins of the First World War and America's involvement of that in that war, and then the subsequent Russian or Bolshevik Revolution, it's impossible to understand what is transpiring in the world today. And so, you know, Ed, just you want to just sort of cover any of your thoughts on the background to the First World War and then how they were able to get America involved in a war that in no way influenced American foreign policy. It certainly shouldn't. It's a war we never should have gotten into any more than we should have been involved in the Second World War, Korea, Vietnam. What's your take on the origins of the First World War, and how can we document that this really was planned long, long before the advent of hostilities?
You know, Stan, I really welcome a chance to talk about this because it's not a topic that normally comes up. The book that you were referring to, of course, is The Creature from Jekyll Island, which is a second look at the Federal Reserve. And when we talk about that book, most of the attention is usually devoted to, you know, how the Federal Reserve System creates money out of nothing, and what a rip-off that is, and what disastrous effects that has on our purchasing power and our even not only our economic freedom but our personal freedoms, et cetera, et cetera. And seldom do we get a chance to talk about this issue that you have raised. And I welcome that because I think it's certainly as important as money. The fact that if we didn't have this the central bank mechanism, as it's called, which our Federal Reserve System is, it is my opinion that most of the great wars of recent history, and I mean by that in the last few hundred years, simply would not have been fought. And to get a little fix on that, or a running understanding of what I'm talking about, I'd like to go back to something I wrote in my book. I devoted a chapter to it. It's called the Rothschild Formula. And it's a kind of a whimsical explanation of I was dealing with the Rothschild dynasty and the fact that this was a family that was creating money out of nothing and making loans to governments and profiting from those loans and profiting from wars and all this sort of thing. And suddenly this plan, this pattern began to emerge. It's as though it formed in front of my eyes like a ghost coming down the staircase, you know. And so I became preoccupied with that. And if you don't mind, I'd like to just take a moment and read that to you.
Please do, because, you know, the nice thing about the evening program is we don't have to interrupt it with a lot of commercials. We can just talk back and forth. So you just go ahead and read it.
I don't often like to read books out loud, especially my own books. But I spent a lot of time on these two pages, and so it would probably save a lot of time by just reading it to
you. Go right ahead.
It starts on page 229, and it says, The Formula. And I wrote, let us imagine a man who is totally pragmatic. He is smarter and more cunning than most men. And in fact, he holds them in thinly disguised contempt. He may respect the talents of a few, but has little concern over the condition of mankind. He has observed that kings and politicians are always fighting over something or other, and has concluded that wars are inevitable. He also has learned that wars can be profitable, not only by lending or creating the money to finance them, but from government favoritism and the granting of commercial subsidies or monopolies. He is not capable of such a primitive feeling as patriotism, so he is free to participate in the funding of any side in any conflict, limited only by factors of self-interest. If such a man were to survey the world around him, it's not difficult to imagine that he would come to the following conclusions, which would become the prime directives of his career. 1. War is the ultimate discipline to any government. If it can successfully meet the challenge of war, it will survive. If it cannot, it will perish. All else is secondary. The sanctity of its laws, the prosperity of its citizens, and the solvency of its treasury will be quickly sacrificed by any government in its primal act of self-survival. 2. All that is necessary, therefore, to ensure that a government will maintain or expand its debt is to involve it in war, or the threat of war. The greater the threat, and the more destructive the war, the greater the need for debt. 3. To involve a country in war, or the threat of war, it will be necessary for it to have enemies with credible military might. If such enemies already exist, all the better. If they exist but lack military strength, it will be necessary to provide them the money to build their war machine. If an enemy does not exist at all, then it will be necessary to create one by financing the rise of a hostile regime. 4. The ultimate obstacle is the government which declines to finance its wars through debt. Although this seldom happens, when it does, it will be necessary to encourage internal political opposition, insurrection, or revolution to replace that government with one that is more compliant to our will. The assassination of heads of state could play an important role in this process. And 5. No nation can be allowed to remain militarily stronger than its adversaries, for that could lead to peace and a reduction of debt. To accomplish this balance of power, it may be necessary to finance both sides of the conflict. Unless one of the combatants is hostile to our interests and therefore must be destroyed, neither side should be allowed a decisive victory or defeat. While we must always proclaim the virtues of peace, the unspoken objective is perpetual war. Now, that's what I call the Rothschild formula. And if you think about that, Stan, you hold that up as kind of a blueprint, you will see that all of the major wars of the last couple of hundred years fit that template beautifully. In fact, perfectly.
Well, now, of course, that is conjecture. Can you actually tie the Rothschilds into the origins of World War I? In other words, we know that certainly the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace was planning on getting America into a war back in 1908, 1909 from the material that your interview with Norman Dodd, an interview that I had done about the same time as yours. And then, so how would that fit in the desire for war on the part of the Carnegie Endowment as a vehicle of creating world government? How would that fit into your thesis on Rothschild?
Well, this is the Rothschild formula, but I did not mean to imply that only the Rothschilds are involved in this kind of thinking.
Okay, I agree with you totally. Certainly, yes. We can see their hand, involved in some of the European wars.
Yes.
And where they were financing both sides during the Napoleonic Wars.
Yes, that's a historical, it's a fact, and it can certainly be well documented. Then you come to a period of history where the hand of the Rothschilds in America becomes rather hidden. But every once in a while it comes to the surface, and you can see that people like J.P. Morgan, for example, who generally are considered to be totally American, actually were Rothschild agents. And some of the more recent histories that have been produced by biographers who are quite friendly to the Morgans, by the way, still have made that point pretty clear.
Can you clarify on that?
But that's not the important point. Right. I'm not trying to nail this on the Rothschilds, because we have many others of all nationalities and ethnic background and from all over the world that follow the Rothschild formula.
In other words, there are people who really believe that war is a means of changing the world.
Oh, yes, changing the world. They think it's inevitable. They think it's the best way to bring about rapid change in a society and they believe that they are smarter than the rest of us, and they should be in charge, and that they will engineer the development of society.
Now, what
so
about,
they see wars as an instrument toward that end.
Now, what about the wars as a vehicle of creating a one-world government? Do you believe that the wars of this last century have played any part in the move towards world government?
Well, I think that is increasingly the primary motive for fighting such wars. Certainly in the last few decades, I would say that is the total motivation for American involvement in wars, in the Middle East, for example, and all these little skirmishes where we're running around the world at Lord knows what we're trying to do. But in my view, that is simply a maneuver, a training maneuver, to condition not only the thinking of the people of the world to accept international military operations, but also to actually train the troops to operate under international command. It's a training exercise as they are developing a world army right under our noses. And that, of course, is an essential ingredient for the development of a true world government.
Yeah, absolutely. You have to have a world army before you have a world government, and that's always really been the plan. What part do you think that this thinking had in the creation of the background to World War I?
Well, as I read that part of history, I think there were two motives involved there. The internationalist motive of bringing the world together through cataclysmic war and shaking up some of the cherished ideas of national sovereignty as a result of the devastation of war, and selling the idea that we must never let this happen again. And therefore, the only way to prevent it from happening again is to destroy nationhood, to get rid of national sovereignty. That was definitely part of it, but there was another important part that surfaced from my research, and that was strictly economic. When war broke out between England and Germany, between the Allied powers of England and France on one side and Germany on the other, there were quite a bit of a lot of money being loaned. We were talking about this, you know, that this was a chance to make some money. And it turns out that the J.P. Morgan group in the United States had heavily invested in the Allied war effort. And it began to look there for a while, lo and behold, that the Allies were going to lose the war or going to have to sue for peace. The Germans were very aggressive, and their U-boat warfare was successful, had just about isolated England. Their shipping lanes had been closed down, and I am told that England was facing a period of perhaps a few weeks before they would run out of food. And it was a desperate situation for England, and it looked as though England was going to literally lose the war. It's hard for us to realize that in these days today where we... You know, we're not given that kind of information. But when you go back and look at the actual dispatches and the news reports that were coming out at that time, this is true. And so J.P. Morgan and his associates were staring at a multi-billion dollar investment that was about to go sour. I mean, if England had lost the war, had to sue for peace or whatever, all of those bonds that had been issued by England to American investors through J.P. Morgan were going to be, they just were not going to be honored. And so that's when the powerful behind-the-scenes forces began to work in the White House and in the State Department, these banking and financial interests of which we're speaking, with powerful political connections, began to use those connections in government and in the media to generate a strong, almost a hysteria among the American people for getting into the war on the side of England and France. Of course, it was sold to the American people as a great the right thing to do because Germany was so evil and had sunk the Lusitania and all of that sort of thing. But the real motives, as I read that chapter of history, was to get the United States taxpayers to finance this war and send war material to England and France to literally save those bonds that were being floated by J.P. Morgan and his investment groups.
And I think that, as I remember, and it's been some time since I read your book, but didn't you actually in your book refer to that article that appeared in the Congressional Record by Congressman Callaway telling about how J.P. Morgan and his associates had bought up control of all of our major newspapers and then used those newspapers to propagandize the American people to get us into the war?
Yes, that's true. That's a matter of historical record. The powers that be figured that the best investment for their money would be to get control over the thinking processes of the American people, and to do that, in the short term, at least, it was necessary to control the major media. The long term, of course, requires controlling the educational institutions, but the short term, just get hold of the media, and it's done. Yeah. And that's what Morgan did.
And it was really so interesting. We actually, of course, not that we didn't trust you totally, but we actually checked that reference out.
Oh, you did?
And
no,
we actually have that available. Any of our listeners out there want to send us a self-addressed stamped envelope with two stamps on it, we'll send you not only that article that was, it comes from the Congressional Record in February of 1917 by Congressman Calloway, but, of course, several other articles we have as well going into the background of thought control in America and how it is that the reality of the American people is created by those who control the media. And those who control the media, of course, go all the way back to this incident back in 1915, 1916, leading up to 1917, America's involvement in the war, when the 25 major newspapers in America and their editorial pages and staff had all been co-opted and simply purchased under contract with J.P. Morgan and his associates to manipulate us into the war. And that was really a fascinating, fascinating a revelation to me, and I think it should be to everyone there in our listening audience. It's there. Ed was absolutely right. And you need to really read that and understand that nothing has changed. It's just gotten worse since then. At that time, they controlled 25 newspapers. Now they control almost every newspaper in America. How, though, did the English and the French get involved in the war? Really, what, you know, we know about the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand, but what were the other factors? I mean, how could you possibly get a war like this started and then continue it for so many years with the total devastation and the, you know, 20 million people killed and another 40 million casualties. And nobody wanted this war. Certainly the English people didn't want it. The French people didn't want it. The German didn't want it. The Kaiser didn't want it. I mean, it destroyed Europe. It destroyed the Austro-Hungarian Empire and the German Empire and the Turkish Empire and the Russian Empire. How did they ever get this war going and then get it, keep it going all that time?
Well, that's a really profound question, Stan, and I'm not sure that I know all of the ramifications of how that was accomplished, but certain things are obvious, and you've already mentioned one of them, and that is that when you can control the media, you do, in fact, you can control the emotions of the masses of the people. You can create almost a hysteria of hatred against another people. And, of course, we've seen that during every war in recent history. The propaganda agencies of the respective governments go to work with posters and stories and music and lyrics and poetry and all of these things to create a very strong patriotism for one's homeland and a great hatred of the enemy. And no holds are barred in this kind of a deal. And it's just difficult for people to realize that sometimes this very same mechanism can be used before the war has broken out. And in fact, that's what actually happened. So controlling the media and controlling the sentiments of the people is one thing. And the other side, of course, is controlling the money. And that perhaps is the stepping stone toward the first thing I mentioned. If you can, in fact, make it profitable for war, there will be large segments of the population pretty much in the in industrial side, and these are very influential people, very wealthy people, who will recognize that they're going to get government contracts, it's going to be profitable. I mean, even today, we see a large segment of our country employed in the military and the aerospace companies, and of course it's very sad for those people to think that we don't have a threat of war.
I think it was so interesting that, you know, there were, the Navy did not want a new aircraft. Or I forgot whether it was helicopters or what it was, but the Navy didn't want it, but Trent Lott insisted on it because they were produced in his area.
Yes.
And, of course, the military didn't want some other things that Newt Gingrich insisted on because those were produced in Georgia, which is his congressional district.
Right.
And, you know, the idea that these men will use their positions of power to get war contracts for war material that's not even needed and the military doesn't even want, and that money could be used for other more important purposes is just so hypocritical.
Yes, well, of course, there's nothing new about that, and that's what these people were talking about decades ago. There will always be a very influential segment of the population who will support war effort and will actually literally rejoice when there is a war or a threat of war because it means profits.
And of course, one of the most interesting things, I don't know if you've seen the executive order on the American Heritage Rivers Initiative that was put forward by Bill Clinton, but the question came up, how was he going to fund this legislation that he had passed completely independent of Congress? And of course, he's funding it out of the Defense Department. I mean, the money that is voted by our congressmen for the defense of the United States and then is being utilized to fund Bill Clinton's American Heritage Rivers Initiative. I mean, just incredible. And of course, any congressman who votes against defense obviously is a bad guy. And yet, look how that money is being spent. And the fact that most people don't know that shows how effective control is. And if you want to get that executive order, we have that one as well. We try to get the documentation for this. Well, you know, I think the background of how who it was within the English government who wanted the war and kept the war going when the Kaiser was ready to stop the war in 1915, according to Ambassador Girard's book, My First 83 Years in America. Fascinating, fascinating study, and maybe we can do that some other time. But there was a small clique within the English government that tied into Cecil Rhodes' secret society. It was made up at that time, really, of Sir Edward Grey and Asquith, who was the British Prime Minister. Edward Grey was the Foreign Minister, and they'd actually been planning the war going back to 1905, and we know that because of all people, Bertrand Russell, in the first volume of his autobiography. He told about a meeting held before Grey became the Foreign Minister, and that was before 1905, in this little secret organization known as the Coefficients, which is described in H.G. Wells' book, An Experiment in Autobiography, and in that book, Wells talks about this secret meeting where Milner and Lord Brand and Leo Amery and all of the people from the Cecil Rhodes Secret Society meeting together with the Fabian Socialists, George Bernard Shaw, H.G. Wells, certainly Bertrand Russell and a few others were all there planning on how they were going to work together to bring about this wonderful new world order they dreamed of. But Bertrand Russell was so upset when he heard Grey talking before 1905 about creating all these alliances against Germany, and he stood up and said, you're going to lead to a war. And of course, nobody was really concerned about that. And he quit the organization, at least to his credit, and tells us a story that as of 1905, they were actually planning on that European war.
Yeah. And all the while talking about being pacifist.
Oh, yes, of course.
How horrible war is.
Right. And then, of course, by 1916, when Asquith was voted out of office and Lloyd George came into office, the man who really surrounded Lloyd George was Milner and his men. And there's a wonderful book called Lloyd George's Secretariat. And if you check Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time against that book, Lloyd George's Secretariat, you'll find out that four of Lloyd George's members of his secretariat came from Milner's roundtable group. They controlled the prime minister. They controlled the British government after 1916 and kept that war going and going and going as more and more boys died in the trenches there in Europe. It's really such a tragic, tragic story. But let's get on into the story of the Lusitania, which you did such a magnificent job describing in your book, Creature from Jekyll Island, because that certainly is looked upon today by many as the reason America went into the First World War. Would you want to tell that story? Because I think it's vitally important.
Yes, indeed it is vitally important. It's been so long that I've looked at it that I may have forgotten some of the details, but the major thrust of the story, one can never forget. The simple fact is that, as I mentioned before, the Morgan Group was quite upset over the possibility of having to forfeit all of its loans to the government of England and France. And so they were doing everything they could to maneuver the United States into a war. And of course, they had a great deal of influence over Woodrow Wilson, who was generally regarded as a pacifist and who went into office based on a campaign that he would keep us out of war, just as FDR did many years later. Both of them presumed to be pacifists. And I believe, actually, that Wilson probably was a pacifist at heart. But he was surrounded by sharks, and they had really total control over his political actions.
Yeah, especially Colonel Edward Mandel.
Yes.
Almost controlled Woodrow Wilson with a hypnotic sort of trance. In fact, Woodrow Wilson is referred to House as my alter ego.
Yes, and I suppose your listening audience is quite quite sophisticated and well-informed on all these issues.
But no, you go ahead and repeat it. In fact, if you want to read the part from your book about the singing of the Lusitania, I think that is the best thing I've ever read on it. That's really outstanding.
Oh, well, I'd have to find it. But anyway, getting back to the little background of how this all began, so they were trying to maneuver the United States into a war, and even though, as you had mentioned before, they had successfully, or were in the process of successfully acquiring control over the major newspapers at the time, and so that the editorial positions of the newspapers had suddenly swung away from pacifism toward the patriotic line of we must preserve the world and keep it safe from dictatorship and so forth. They were doing their best to whip up a patriotic fervor, but it wasn't working. The people were saying, ho hum, I still don't think I like the idea. And so they needed an event. They needed something dramatic. They needed something very emotional. And frankly, they saw in the Lusitania a possibility of creating such an event. The Lusitania was of course a passenger ship owned by the British, the Cunard Lines, and it was a huge, magnificent ship. But it had been built also to operate as a warship if necessary. It had been built to military standards, and it had very fast engines in it, and it could be converted to a warship probably within a month or 2 months. That was the intent when it was built. But at the time, it was serving as a passenger ship and a cargo ship.
And we're going to have to interrupt you there, and I'm going to ask Howard if he'd get me a couple of glasses of water here. And we're going to be back in just a moment with Ed Griffin, author of the book, The Creature from Jekyll Island. Incidentally, it's available by calling 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Probably one of the finest books we have on the background of the world monetary system. But we'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, Ed Griffin, and his book we're talking about is The Creature from Jekyll Island. Of course, he's put together many, many other fascinating books. The Fearful Master, his book on the United Nations, was a classic. I think it's out of print now, isn't it, Ed?
Which one is that? World
the Fearful Master.
Oh, The Fearful Master, yes. And I've been under a lot of pressure to revise that and update it and bring it back in.
I really think it was something that's really important. How can people get in touch with your organization? Because Ed has a tape sets that he puts out. He puts out 3 tapes a month, and he's trying to recruit people to take these tapes on a regular basis. He offers videos, and some of the finest videos, you know, that really give you various aspects of what's going on are available through his organization. It's American Media, isn't it?
Yes, it is. We've kind of improved our image a little bit. While we still are American Media, we decided that sounds a little bit too conservative and too ho-hum. So our marketing name now is The Reality Zone.
The Reality Zone.
Well, how do you like that?
Okay, fine. Well, if you'd like to get in touch with The Reality Zone, how can people do that?
Okay, well, we're on the Internet. We have a website, and it's realityzone.com. And we're just getting that up to speed. Or, of course, the tried and true method is to give us a call at our 800 number.
And what's that?
And that's 800-595-6596. 595-6596. And I'd be really happy to send a catalog and tell them all about the Reality Zone audio archive.
All right, fine. And there are a lot of fascinating videos that are available through Ed's organization, and these are the classic videos that go back into, well, we could even spend a whole evening just talking about some of the amazing videos that you have. You actually carry that one on Hungary, don't you? On the great famine, the great hunger that they had, and the planned famine in Russia?
Oh, yes, you betcha. We have that one.
Okay.
Harvest of Despair.
Harvest of Despair.
Yeah, it's a classic, and it's incredible to realize that, we're off on that one.
Well, we don't want to get off on these. We'd want to stick with the one subject.
Right, the Lusitania.
The Lusitania. So why don't you tell the story of the sinking of the Lusitania, planned sinking of the Lusitania, because it was used just as Pearl Harbor was used in an effort to bring America into the war.
Well,
the only good thing is it didn't work.
Well, you know, you suggested it. I think I'm going to make you unhappy that you suggested that I read this.
No, I won't be unhappy at all.
During the break, I was just looking here, and I thought this is pretty succinct. I'll start on 247 until it gets too boring.
It won't be too boring. Right to the very end, I was so impressed by that. It had an emotional appeal. So you go right ahead and read that. And for those of you in the listening audience who want to get a copy of it, we do carry the book. There's so many good things in it. But this is one of the finest descriptions of one of the great American tragedies that it was used to manipulate the American people. So without further ado, Mr. Ed Griffin.
Okay, well, in the pages just prior to this, Stan, I had pointed out the fact that J.P. Morgan had a strong financial interest in shipping. In fact, he was a primary investor in the German shipping lines and in the two British shipping lines that were competitors of the Cunard Company. And so the Cunard Company was his competitor, and for all practical purposes, the Lusitania was the only major ship that was in competition against his own financial interests. So now you see that's a little interesting background that might put a little different light on this. So here we go. The Lusitania was a British passenger liner that sailed regularly between Liverpool and New York. She was owned by the Cunard Company, which, as previously mentioned, was the only major ship line which was a competitor of the Morgan cartel. She left New York Harbor on May 1, 1915, and was sunk by a German submarine off the coast of Ireland 6 days later. Of the 1,195 persons who lost their lives, 195 were Americans. It was this event, more than any other, that provided the advocates of war with a convincing platform for their views, and it became the turning point where Americans reluctantly began to accept, if not the necessity of war, at least its inevitability. The fact that the Lusitania was a passenger ship is misleading. Although she was built as a luxury liner, her construction specifications were drawn up by the British Admiralty, so she could be converted, if necessary, into a ship of war. Everything from the horsepower of her engines and the shape of her hull to the placement of ammunition storage areas were, in fact, military designs. She was built specifically to carry 12 6-inch guns. The construction costs for these features were paid for by the British government. Even in times of peace, it was required that her crew include officers and seamen from the Royal Navy Reserve. In May of 1913, she was brought back into dry dock and outfitted with extra armor, revolving gun rings on her decks, and shell racks in the hold for ammunition. Handling elevators to lift the shells to the guns were also installed. 12 high-explosive cannons were delivered to the dry dock. All this is a matter of public record at the National Maritime Museum in Greenwich, England. But whether the guns were actually installed at that time is still hotly debated. There is no evidence that they were. In any event, on September 17, the Lusitania returned to sea, ready for the vigors of war, and she was entered into the Admiralty Fleet Register, not as a passenger liner, but as an armed auxiliary cruiser. From then on, she was listed in Jane's Fighting Ships as an auxiliary cruiser, and in the British publication, the Naval Annual, as an armed merchantman. Part of the dry dock modification was to remove all the passenger accommodations in the lower deck to make room for more military cargo. Thus, the Lusitania became one of the most important carriers of war materials, including munitions, from the United States to England. On March 8, 1915, after several close calls with German submarines, the captain of the Lusitania turned in his resignation. He was willing to face the U-boats, he said, but he was no longer willing, quote, to carry the responsibility of mixing passengers with munitions or contraband, end quote. Now, from England's point of view, the handwriting on the wall was becoming quite clear. Unless the United States could be brought into the war as her ally, she soon would have to sue for peace. The challenge was how to push Americans off their position of stubborn neutrality. How that was accomplished is one of the most controversial aspects of the war. It is inconceivable to many that English leaders might have deliberately plotted the destruction of one of their own vessels with American citizens aboard as a means of drawing the United States into the war as an ally. Surely, any such idea is merely German propaganda. Robert Ballard, writing in National Geographic, says, quote, "Within days of the sinking, German sympathizers in New York came up with a conspiracy theory. The British Admiralty, they said, had deliberately exposed Lusitania to harm, hoping she would be attacked and thus draw the U.S. into the war," end quote. Okay, let's take a closer look at this conspiracy theory. Winston Churchill, who was first Lord of the Admiralty at that time, said, here, this is really going to be interesting. This is Churchill speaking now. He said, there are many kinds of maneuvers in war. There are maneuvers in time, in diplomacy, in mechanics, in psychology, all of which are removed from the battlefield, but react often decisively upon it. The maneuver which brings an ally into the field is as serviceable as that which wins a great battle. The maneuver which gains an important strategic point may be less valuable than that which placates or overawes a dangerous neutral, end quote. Now, the maneuver chosen by Churchill was particularly ruthless. Under what was called the cruiser rules, warships of both England and Germany gave the crews of unarmed enemy merchant ships a chance to take to the lifeboats before sinking them. But in October of 1914, Churchill issued orders that British merchant ships must no longer obey a U-boat order to halt and be searched. If they had armament, which many of them did, they were to engage the enemy. If they did not have armament, they were to attempt to ram the sub. The immediate result of this change was to force German U-boats to remain submerged for protection and to simply sink the ships without warning. Why would the British want to do such a stupid thing that would cost the lives of thousands of their own seamen? The answer is that it was not an act of stupidity. It was cold-blooded strategy. Churchill boasted, quote, the first British countermove made on my responsibility was to deter the Germans from surface attack. The submerged U-boat had to rely increasingly on underwater attack and thus ran the greater risk of mistaking neutral for British ships and of drowning neutral crews and thus embroiling Germany with other great powers, end quote. To add to the likelihood of accidentally sinking a ship of a neutral great power, Churchill ordered British ships to remove their names from the hulls, and when in port, to fly the flag of a neutral power, preferably that of the United States. As a final maneuver, the British Navy was ordered not to treat captured U-boat crew members as prisoners of war, but as felons. Survivors, wrote Churchill, should be taken prisoner or shot, whichever is the most convenient, end quote. Other orders, which now are an embarrassing part of official Navy archives, were even more ruthless. Quote, in all actions, white flags should be fired upon with promptitude, end quote. Well, I guess that's enough reading. What was going on there is that Churchill, on his side, was deliberately setting up a situation in which it was inevitable that the Germans would sink a ship of a neutral power, preferably that of the United States, with Americans on it, and this would create the support among the neutral power citizenry to come into the war on the side of England. So he was willing to sacrifice English ships and English seamen as a small price to pay for bringing America into the war. Now, that was Churchill's motive, and you can possibly say, well, I can understand that. Better to lose a few lives if you can win the war. And so what we found is that there were motives all over the place. The English had their motives. J.P. Morgan had his motives. The internationalists like Woodrow Wilson has his motives. They all were conspiring against the American people to get us into war.
And, of course, who was the American Assistant Secretary of the Navy at that time? Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Yes, of course.
And just 30 years later, yeah. Of course, 20 years later, why Churchill would be the Prime Minister of England, and
Franklin Delano
Roosevelt would be,
yes.
Right, and Roosevelt would be the President of the United States, and it was deja vu all over again,
yes.
Only this time they called it Pearl Harbor.
Yes.
So why don't you tell the rest of the story? Because
I won't read it, but it's really quite a fascinating story. The Lusitania was loaded with munitions and gun cotton and explosives of all kinds. And even things which were not explosives were also considered contraband. I mean, we have to remember that at that time, the United States had entered into a neutrality treaty with Germany and England, which means that they had agreed not to ship munitions or even non-munitions which were essential to a war effort. And J.P. Morgan had special contract here in the United States to produce all kinds of contraband equipment, and the Lusitania was loaded from top to bottom with contraband, including munitions.
But didn't the Germans actually try to discourage Americans from going on it, but saying and putting ads in the newspapers all across America, or trying to put those ads in, saying, don't go on this ship because it's going to be sunk, you know, this is a ship of war. And what happened when the Germans tried to put those ads in American newspapers?
Well, the U.S. State Department called the newspapers and said, if you publish that ad, you are going to be in serious trouble, legal trouble. And they pressured the newspapers into not publishing that notice. There was only one little newspaper which carried it, and it wasn't even in New York, but it did carry it, so it's a matter of public record. And it, in fact, I'm looking at it right now, the little ad put out by the Imperial German Embassy, dated April 22, 1915, said, notice, travelers intending to embark on the Atlantic voyage are reminded that a state of war exists between Germany and her allies and Great Britain and her allies, that the zone of war includes the waters adjacent to the British Isles, that in accordance with formal notice given by the Imperial German government, vessels flying the flag of Great Britain or any of her allies are liable to destruction in those waters, and that travelers sailing in the war zone on ships of Great Britain or her allies do so at their own risk. And that, as I said, was squelched in all of the New York papers by the U.S. State Department.
And I think what was really so interesting is that the Secretary of State at that time was William Jennings Bryan.
Yes.
And William Jennings Bryan had nothing to do with it. The State Department ran itself, and he was simply a figurehead. In fact, he was so upset about when he found out what had happened, I think subsequently he actually resigned as Secretary
yes.
of State.
Yes, he was so upset when he realized that that he had been part of this plot, literally a plot to maneuver us into war and to sacrifice American lives in the process. And he was so destroyed by that. He decided not to speak out because I guess he felt he wanted to be a team player, but he did resign in great sadness.
So anyway, now the ship, the Americans are getting onto it, and some of the Americans are concerned. They've heard rumors about the fact that Germans are threatening to sink this ship, and don't they go to the State Department and say, you know, really maybe we shouldn't be going? And what was the response?
Well, the response is, don't worry about it. There's no contraband on that ship, that they have no information about that, and just don't worry about it. That's
sure.
the basic thing.
In other words, all of those Americans were set up to be killed.
They were set up to be killed.
And
so the ship went into the English waters, and by order of Churchill, I believe it had three boilers, yeah, or four boilers, I've forgotten, three or four. Anyway, one of them was deliberately closed down, supposedly to save coal. Well, of course, that means that it could not move as fast as it was designed to move, and a slow target is much easier to hit with a torpedo than a fast target.
And then they were supposed to have a rendezvous with a British destroyer
yes.
to be there to protect it from
yes,
submarine
to protect
attack.
It.
And then what happened to that destroyer?
Well, Churchill called it off. And in the war room there, they called the destroyer away so that the great Lusitania was left absolutely alone in enemy waters where they knew several submarines had been active within the 48 hours previous. They knew that there were German submarines in those very waters, and they had sunk several British boats just the day before. And they let the Lusitania go into it, closed down one of its boilers so it couldn't go as fast as it might otherwise, and took away its escort. So in other words, it was set up to be sunk.
In fact, in your book, you quote from a military officer, a naval officer who was there
yeah.
In the war room. When he realized what this was all about, he just left in disgust. What was that story?
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
Well, yes, I can't remember the fellow's name now, but anyway, he was there, and in true British fashion, you know, he tried to be as discreet as he could, but he was pretty plain. He said that he sat there and he couldn't believe watching his superiors deliberately. They had a big map on the wall, and they had a map on the table, and a big marker showing the Lusitania. They had other markers showing the position, the last reported position of the German submarines. And they stood there and pushed the markers, and they watched the submarines move closer to the marker for the Lusitania, and just watched and did nothing until finally the word came in that the Lusitania was sunk.
And think it was that very same day. Was it your quotation from the writings of Lord Escher, where Colonel House is visiting Lord Escher? And,
yeah.
In fact, I bought all four volumes of Lord Escher's diary so I could actually have that and actually read that. And do you remember that story?
Well, yes. The captain, William Turner, was actually made to be the scapegoat. The British Admiralty, of course, needed somebody to take the blame other than the Admiralty itself. And so they tried to make it look like the captain was remiss in the way he handled the matter, when in fact he was merely following orders. And, of course, they tried to court-martial him. And the man that was put in charge of that court-martial, I can't think of it, Mersey, M-E-R-S-E-Y, he just wouldn't go along with it. He was under orders to dump the blame onto Captain Turner, but he didn't do it. And at the end, he said, in fact, I found the quote here. This is what Lord Mersey wrote. He said, "Blame ought not to be imputed to the captain. His omission to follow the advice in all respects cannot fairly be attributed either to negligence or incompetence." End quote. And then he added a final paragraph, which on the surface appears to be a condemnation of the Germans, but which, if read with understanding of the background, was a pure indictment of Churchill, Wilson, and Morgan. And this was what he wrote at the very end of his report. He said, "The whole blame for the cruel destruction of life in this catastrophe must rest solely with those who plotted and with those who committed the crime." Everybody thought he was talking about Germany, but he wasn't.
Of course, and it was the same thing that happened at Pearl Harbor when they tried to court-martial Admiral Kimmel and General Short, who were just carrying out all their orders and, of course, had been told that when the attack came, it would come on the Philippines, and that's why they, of course, pulled all the aircraft carriers out of Pearl Harbor, so they couldn't, you know, they just couldn't put their battleships to sea without air coverage. And then they ordered that all the airplanes be gathered together in the center of the airfield for sabotage alert, to make them an enticing target for the Japanese as they tracked the movement of the Japanese fleet across the Pacific.
See, it's the same strategy.
Deja vu all over again, and of course the same characters there, because people did not learn the lessons of the First World War. Then, of course, we were doomed to repeat them during the Second World War.
It was interesting, thinking back on that situation with the Lusitania, this Lord Mersey, after he had completed his hearings and submitted the report, which I just quoted from, he wrote to Prime Minister Asquith and turned down his fee for services during that whole trial. And then he added a little line. He said, "I must request that henceforth I be excused from administering His Majesty's justice." So he resigned. He just couldn't take it.
A listener called in, wants to know why they thought that the sinking of the Lusitania would get the American to the war. And of course, at one point, you actually quote from a conversation that's recorded in Lord Escher's diary, where Colonel House is visiting Lord Escher. And the subject comes up as to what would happen if the Lusitania was sunk. And Colonel House, and this is the day of the sinking, says, "Why, of course, America would go into the war at that time. This would provoke America to enter into the war." So they really
believed. At the very time the ship was sailing into its death waters, they were discussing how that would probably play out.
Right. This was all preconceived, all planned, and the tragedy is it's deja vu all over again, whether the, if you read the story of America getting into the Korean War, and it's all covered in MacArthur's reminiscences, how the Secretary of State, Dean Acheson, gets up and says, "If South Korea is attacked, we will not defend it," and the Joint Chiefs of Staff get up and say, "If South Korea is attacked by North Korea, we will not defend it," and so Kim Il-sung, stupid communist dictator that he is, attacks North Korea, believing America won't come into the war, and of course immediately we're in the war, and now the Korean War is underway. And the same thing, the phony Gulf of Tonkin incident that got us into Vietnam, the way that they manipulated Saddam Hussein into going into Kuwait by telling him that it really weren't concerned what was going to happen, you know, the matters between Saddam Hussein and Kuwait were of no concern at all to America. And then, of course, as soon as Saddam, foolishly believing what he'd been told by April Glaspie, the American ambassador, as soon as his troops move into Kuwait, why, then immediately the atrocity stories kept coming out. And I wonder how many of our listeners remember all those atrocity stories about the horrible Iraqi soldiers bayoneting little children, infants, you know, in the nurseries and the hospitals, all to provoke the emotion from the American people to justify our going into that, that senseless war, with the idea that first it'll be, Kuwait, then Saudi Arabia, then all the world, you know, as if suddenly Saddam Hussein is the great threat to the peace of the world.
Yes, well, they demonize these people, and you know, that doesn't make them angels by a long shot, but there are plenty of demons out there that we continue to support, and I don't know why we have to, you know, choose up sides in the first place. Well, of course, I do know, because as I said earlier, the name of the whole game here is to rehearse for an international military force and to get the world used to resolving conflicts with international force, and to gradually eliminate the nation as a realistic entity in the world. And so that's what it's all about.
And, of course, the slogan of the First World War was really said it all. This is to be the war to end all wars. And it had to do with the establishment of the League of Nations, the world government, which is what it was all about.
Yes. Well, of course, we've had more wars since then, and more death and suffering by war since the end of World War II than ever before. And the casualty statistics are just absolutely stunning. But we call this a time of peace.
Right. Well, let's see. I think the listener wants us to answer the question, why, if Germany was just weeks from victory over England, did she sink the Lusitania? And certainly create a situation where, the American sympathy would then go with the English.
Well, I think that that's a hard one to answer. I guess in order for the Germans not to sink the Lusitania, they would have to stop sinking just about every ship, because they would have no way of knowing which ships had Americans on them and which ones didn't. I suppose conceivably the German captain in that U-boat might have been informed, but you know, that'd be a tough one to call, too, to say, hey, well, we can't touch this biggest of all ships carrying all those munitions to England simply because they've got 156 Americans on board. I think it's safe to say that the Germans probably didn't realize how much propaganda value that would have.
Yeah, I think that people can't understand the ferocity of this war. At Verdun, 400,000 Germans fell in that battle, and 400,000 French fell in the battle. I mean, and you're going to worry about 100 and some odd Americans, you know? You're talking about a war, a genocidal war, as it were, you know? And so people, if you're a submarine commander, you're not thinking of the geopolitics. You're thinking about trying to save the fatherland.
Right, well, he was...